This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
How are you feeling about where you spend your money? Have your habits changed? Because the economic recovery kind of depends on that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 24th of May. Good to have you with us. We start today with a forecast from a closely watched survey in the business world. The National Association for Business Economics expects the U.S. economy to grow by 6.5% this year. That's up from its prediction of just under 5% a few months ago. And it would be the fastest growth since 1984 as the country recovered from another severe recession. With more people getting vaccinated and pandemic restrictions lifting, the hope is that consumers will return to old habits and then some. Shopping, taking vacations, going to movie theaters. We have some clues about that last part from the UK. Theaters there reopened a week ago, and the Cineworld chain of theaters had a strong weekend. Here in the States, the upcoming Memorial Day weekend will be a big box office test. Marketplace's Marielle Segura reports.
When movie theaters were open this past year, they didn't sell many tickets, and that created a downward spiral. Studios didn't want to release their big movies to empty theaters, so then the theaters had no new films to draw people in.
It's been a real chicken and egg situation for quite a while.
That's Sean Robbins, chief analyst with Box Office Pro. He says things are looking up now. More than half of Americans have gotten at least one dose of the COVID vaccine.
And studios are committing to releasing major films again, essentially on a weekly basis for the rest of the year.
Starting this Memorial Day weekend with Cruella, the Disney origin story, and A Quiet Place Part 2, the horror movie with Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. Sisters Movie House, an independent theater in Oregon that just reopened at 50% capacity, will be showing both films. Owner Drew Kaza isn't worried.
I'm pretty sure we'll be pushing those capacity constrictions, put it that way.
Right now, people are eager to do anything that feels like going back to normal. Jason E. Squire at the USC School of Cinematic Arts says that's especially true for movies.
There's this enormous pent-up emotional need to go to movie theaters, to enjoy movies, you know, in the exciting circumstance of the dark room with strangers around you. This is a time-honored entertainment experience.
Theaters will have competition. A lot of people have gotten used to streaming movies from home. Drew Kaza at Sisters Movie House says he thinks the crowds will keep coming, though.
Well, we're pretty optimistic about this year for the, you know, the main reason is we look at this as being the most solid year product-wise maybe in my lifetime. So if that doesn't draw people out, I don't know what will, but I think it will.
Some other movies out this summer, In the Heights, Black Widow, and Fast and Furious 9. I'm Marielle Segura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders seem pretty optimistic about the recovery. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow, it will be 1 year since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and there will be a lot of accounting in the coming days of what's changed since protests erupted all over the country demanding racial justice and equality for Black Americans. A lot of brand name corporations made big promises. JP Morgan Chase, Target, Apple, and many others pledged to invest in Black communities, devote shelf space to Black-owned business, and increase diversity in their workplaces. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes stock now of whether those promises were kept.
First came all the statements.
It was something that we hadn't seen before in this space. The majority of the S&P 500 did make some type of statement regarding George Floyd's murder.
Then, mostly radio silence. Olivia Knight is with As You Sow, a nonprofit monitoring company diversity, equity, and inclusion.
We felt that a lot of the corporate commitments weren't as detailed as we were hoping for.
Some companies used buzzwords without defining goals, and the companies that did set benchmarks, say committing shelf space to Black-owned businesses or increasing the number of Black managers, well, there's no official system that holds them accountable. It's why William Michael Cunningham, CEO of Creative Investment Research, wants to create an independent trust.
Make your pledges real by giving us a piece of paper that says that, yes, we've made this pledge and we empower this trustee to keep track.
For now, his research firm tracks corporate promises by monitoring press releases. Cunningham says American corporations have pledged $50 billion to racial equity and only spent $250 million. He worries a lot of companies, especially those with longer-term plans, won't follow through.
Oh, the corporations can say 5 years from now, business changed, you know? Our income went down, we're struggling, so we can't fulfill that promise.
At the moment, shareholders are stepping in. Geeta Rao, who teaches social impact investing at MIT, says they're increasingly pushing companies to report progress on diversity efforts, the same way they report sustainability practices.
There will be some kind of, at some point, standardization of disclosure, and in a way that is not too burdensome for companies either.
Rao says focusing on public corporations' commitments won't just make sure dollars and diversity numbers materialize. It'll set a standard for how all companies do business. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We think a lot about the human voice around here, naturally. It's not just the words people say, but how they say it that listeners respond to. Businesses that want to sell us stuff are paying attention to our voices, too. Imagine you're sick at home and you're coughing and your smart speaker picks that up and asks if you'd like a recipe for chicken soup or to maybe order some cough drops with 1 hour delivery. That's the scenario laid out in one of Amazon's patents. And Joe Turow, a communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania, writes about it in his new book, The Voice Catchers. Professor Turow, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
So is that scenario with the Amazon patent something that is actually happening?
Not quite yet. But
thank
there are a
God.
Lot of things that come. Yeah, well, wait a little while. There are a lot of things that come close to it. A Halo is this new Fitbit-like device that Amazon sells. You can put it on, and as you talk to people, it begins to think, how do you sound to your spouse? How do you sound to your boss? How do you sound to your friends? And at the end of the day, we'll tell you what your emotional aura was as you spoke to them.
So many questions about this. I mean, first of all, is this technology good at recognizing what you call the emotional aura? How sophisticated is it in terms of recognizing mood and health?
Well, companies believe it's very sophisticated. They think that by using technologies that look at the sound that you have, and also they'll say syntax, and sometimes in combination with the actual words you use, they think it helps them sell and make people feel better. How do they know? Where do they get the data from? Amazon's pretty close-lipped about it.
You argue in the book that voice profiling is a gateway to a whole new era of biometric profiling by marketers, even more than facial recognition. Why is that?
Yeah, well, facial is, of course, important. The thing about facial, though, is people are worried about it. And it's not as integrated into the home as voice is becoming. I mean, some people have 3, 4, 5 of these devices in their home. They talk to their phones every day. Car companies are putting them into automobiles. I spoke to new home builders who are integrating them directly into the walls of the home. So these are going to become part of our everyday experiences. Turn on the light, turn down the shades. And as a result, the notion of giving data to companies and then having them evaluate them is going to become more and more plausible.
You know, you say we are doing this all the time, but I think a lot of folks are pretty resistant to this technology. What about you? Do you have any of these devices in your house?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I did it in the beginning because I felt I had to learn about it. You can't write about this stuff without having it.
Right.
I have a Google device in my study here, and I have a couple of Amazon devices around the house. I'm not too happy with the idea, however, and if I got the sense that they were beginning to go more into profiling me, I would probably shut them off.
For people who are really creeped out about marketers using our supposed mood to sell us things, are there any positive societal benefits to this technology? For example, someone living alone and a device kind of paying attention to how they're sounding that day.
There are companies that are looking into trying to see whether voice can be a predictor of someone's health. Looking, for example, at Alzheimer's disease, can a person's voice predict whether a person is becoming more and more likely to have Alzheimer's? And these things are really important. My suggestion in the book, this stuff should be banned from marketing. To me, that's a red line, see? Think of the dangers of a society where immigrants, for example, are listened to not just by what they say, but for their sounds of supposedly where they come from. Or a prisoner in an authoritarian country who is not just tried for saying something, but what the computer says they sounded like when they said that. And there are a lot of really scary things that one can spin off in all of this, and we have to be scared of that.
What do you want both consumers and, I should say, regulators to take away from your book?
For consumers, I want us to be wary, to realize that this is a kind of seductive surveillance. There are so many historical precedents to the idea that we can get used to almost anything, okay? I mean, we can get used to things because they seem like they're terrific. And down the line, we see negative aspects. So I say we have to be wary. When it comes to regulators, my point is that regulators have not been so great at actually regulating a lot of our marketing technologies. And I think when it comes to something like voice and other biometrics, sometimes it's okay to say, no, we're not going to allow it.
Joe Turow is author of the new book, The Voice Catchers, How Marketers Listen In to Exploit Your Feelings, Your Privacy, and Your Wallet. Thanks so much for talking with me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up,
how are you still selling navy suits?
It's a classic. Suit sales as an economic indicator. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 186 points, 0.5%, to finish at 34,393. The NASDAQ jumped 190 points, 1.4%, to end at 13,661. And the S&P 500 was up 41 points, just shy of 1%, to land at 4197. For the first time in more than 2 years, a Virgin Galactic spaceship made it to the edge of outer space over the weekend. The mission brings the company one step closer to its goal of offering tourist flights. Shares picked up almost 28%. And back on Earth, Norwegian Cruise Lines plans to start sailing from U.S. ports again in August. Shares gained 4.7%. Rival Royal Caribbean Group added 3.6%. Carnival pocketed 2.6%. Closing arguments started today in Epic Games' antitrust lawsuit against Apple. Shares in Apple gained 1.33%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. I did something this morning I haven't done in, I don't know, forever, it feels like. Ate breakfast at a restaurant inside. It's the kind of discretionary spending economists and a whole lot of businesses are counting on as restrictions lift and more people feel safe out and about. The CDC says more than 61% of U.S. adults have received at least one vaccine dose. But it turns out they may not be the ones driving the consumer recovery, at least not yet. Sarah Chaney Cambon covers economics for The Wall Street Journal, where she had this story today. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You found out that vaccinated people are actually spending less than people who are unvaccinated. What's going on there?
Right. So data from a couple of different research firms suggests that vaccinated consumers are less likely to go out to restaurants and entertainment venues and salons than non-vaccinated people or people who do not plan to get the vaccine are doing.
That seems counterintuitive.
It does. And I think that what's going on here is that we are still in the early stages of the recovery and of the vaccine rollout. One of the analysts I spoke with characterized it pretty well and said, you know, the vaccinated are proceeding with cautious optimism. So they are going out more to restaurants than they were in January, for instance, but they're just not going out as much as people who don't plan to get the vaccine. And the people who are not vaccinated have already kind of been living a relatively normal life throughout this whole pandemic.
Your reporting shows that vaccination rates are higher in so-called blue states, states that voted for President Joe Biden. Could this difference in spending lead to an uneven economic recovery between red states and blue states?
So far, it has. I mean, throughout the pandemic, we've seen that blue states have been recovering slower than red states. And the degree to which that continues is really dependent on, a multitude of things, but one of them is certainly whether these more vaccinated states and people who are vaccinated opt to go out more this summer. And analysts expect that to happen. So you could see a convergence between the performance, the economic performance of red states and blue states as soon as this summer.
This sort of speaks to the transition period we're in right now, where even a lot of vaccinated people are reluctant to take off that mask and to return to, you know, life as normal. You spoke to a woman in Dayton, Ohio, who was fully vaccinated and didn't expect to go back to her pre-pandemic normal until next year. Do you think a lot of people are in that situation?
I do think that Deborah, who's from Ohio, is pretty representative of a lot of the people who are vaccinated in the nation. You know, she did say that she just recently went out and ate indoors at a restaurant for the first time in about a year. But she noted that she was definitely, you know, holding off on going back to any musical productions. The last one she went to was in New York right before COVID hit, and she was remarking on how crazy it was that they were in this really crowded space, right? She said she was hopeful that she would return to kind of pre-pandemic norms by next year, but it just kind of is dependent on what other people around her are doing and, you know, how quickly she can kind of shake off the experiences of the past year.
So I mentioned I went out to breakfast today and it felt so good, even if a little strange. Where are you with going out to eat?
Yes, yeah. So definitely going out to eat more these days. And, you know, I think it's funny just in general how kind of doing things that used to be so normal now feel strange, you know, like seeing an old friend and you figure out, are we going to do a handshake or a hug or what? So it's, yeah. It's just a very
weird... Are we going to keep elbow bumping people? I hope not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Sarah Cheney Cambon covers economics for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
Couple of quick notes. The next official reading of consumer spending is out this Friday. We'll get the month in review for April. And you can always review the latest business headlines every morning. Listen to the Marketplace Morning Report. We talked about U.S. vaccination rates. In the U.K., more than 70% of adults have now received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine. And as restrictions on gatherings continue to loosen up, more workers are also under pressure to head back to the office in the City of London. That's where a lot of big banks and financial companies have their U.K. headquarters. Businesses that cater to those workers are ready to welcome them back. But after months of working from home in sweatpants, will traders be ready to put on their best clothes and book a table for a power lunch? The BBC's Victoria Craig hit the streets of London to find out.
At a corner table in the back of the M Threadneedle restaurant near the Bank of England, a business meeting gets underway over dishes of gnocchi and Korean-style fried chicken. The power lunch has typically been used to forge or maintain professional relationships and strike deals, but the practice has been losing a bit of its luster.
It's a lovely thought that we all sit down and do a lunch like the Wolf on Wall Street. We have a martini every 6 minutes and then fall over. I think when I started in the city 30 years ago, definitely. Now, I think people are working a lot harder and there are, frankly, more rules and regulations about it.
Russ Mould is investment director at the London-listed brokerage AJ Bell. He says the very common and widely accepted practice of weekday power lunching has seen a decline in recent years because of a raft of new rules around bribery and coercion.
I think there will still be a desire to meet people, whether it's over a bottle of wine and an enormous steak. I'm not sure that's necessarily going to be the case.
Rules are one thing, leading to a change in behavior, but the pandemic is another. And it's dealt the latest blow to an industry built around the power lunch tradition. Martin Williams is the boss of M Restaurants, the parent company of M Threadneedle.
We've got 8 restaurants in the financial district of London, and they're 90% based around corporate entertaining. So we're still only working at about 50% capacity. We've still got a long way to go.
Banks like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs have signaled they want workers back at their city offices after months of doing business meetings over Zoom. And Williams says he and his team have a plan to lure more of those workers through their doors.
We're working with some businesses doing welcome back to the city packages for them, which may be based around a set lunch. It may be based around giving gift cards to their workers as they return. We've got lots of CEOs from a lot of corporate institutions and financial institutions who are regulars with us, and we've been quite bespoke in what we've created for them.
Full reservation books are one indicator of normalcy returning to the UK's financial capital. Suit sales are another. London's Savile Row is famed for its luxury tailors, which produce suits costing in the $3,000 to $4,000 range. Taj Full is head of retail at Huntsman, a 171-year-old Savile Row tailor that counts Winston Churchill, Bing Crosby, and the British royal family among its clients.
I can comfortably say the past 4 weeks, so post since we opened up today, we've had our best 4 weeks over the past 12 months.
Since reopening last month, Huntsman has seen a threefold increase in new female customers, and both men's and women's two- and three-piece suits have been flying off the shelves.
It was funny, I was walking down the road 3 weeks ago and a merchant came up to me and was like, "How are you still selling navy suits? We've got the demand for it. Our clients still are returning to the office. They want navy suits."
So after a year of isolation, London's financial heart is finally starting to beat again.
City workers are ready to don power suits to power lunch once again. But as case numbers of new coronavirus variants threaten the return to normal, businesses are hoping the initial enthusiasm persists. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace. This final note on the way out, I dare you not to check the mirror after hearing this. One of the products apparently flying off store shelves these days as the masks come off, teeth whitener. Walmart says sales of teeth whitening products are up as face covering restrictions ease. Also popular, according to the Wall Street Journal, are other products you might expect when people come out of hibernation: deodorant, condoms, luggage, and alarm clocks. That's it. We gotta go, but not before your moment of economic context. Tomorrow we'll get an update on home prices from an indicator with what has to be the longest name of any we follow, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index. And it kind of feels like they're preparing us for a big number. In my inbox today, a statement from CoreLogic Deputy Chief Economist Selma Hepp. With demand in high gear and no respite in sight, she says, home price growth is likely to remain in double digits over the coming quarter. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.